Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
Tapping into the Film Spotting archive here because new in theaters this weekend is Godzilla Times Kong? I'm not really sure what the X is supposed to stand for, but it's the new Empire. If you haven't been paying attention, it belongs to the extended universe of films that includes 2014's Godzilla, 2017's Kong Skull Island, 2019's King of the Monsters, and 2021's first pairing of the two cinematic giants, Godzilla, I know this one, V Kong, as in versus Kong. I've seen at least one of these. How about you, Josh?
Yes. Yeah, I'm entering the monsterverse for this full scale, Adam. And first
really?
Of all, yeah, I think I'm just going to go Godzilla Kong. I'm going to ignore the X. Godzilla Kong, the new empire. All right.
Okay.
So for me, at least moving forward, that's what it'll be. Yeah. Looking ahead to this, I realized I had already seen two of these. I'd seen Godzilla and I'd somehow also seen Godzilla versus Kong. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to get ready. I'm going to jump into the monsterverse. I watched Kong Skull Island. Pretty good. About a week ago. And so all I need to do is Godzilla King of the Monsters. And I will be all ready for Godzilla Kong.
I'm so shamed.
The new empire, which I think I'm going to see on IMAX next week. Pretty excited. Now, back in 2021, we didn't review Godzilla v. Kong, but, you know, we thought let's do some counter programming around that time. And so we instead discussed 1933's King Kong along with 1954's Godzilla. And yes, we forced ourselves to answer once and for all, which classic monster movie reigns supreme?
We had to make it Godzilla v. Kong. We did it in our way.
Exactly. And I guess this speaks to how hard of a question it is. I don't remember what my answer was.
I remember mine. I don't remember yours. I can't remember if we disagreed or not. I know I love both films, and so do you.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to listen ourselves and find out.
We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
We do love our irrational rankings here on Film Spotting, Adam, from our top five list to our deathmatch poll questions to Film Spotting Madness. So yeah, what better way to jump on the Godzilla versus Kong bandwagon than pitting the two films that birthed these monsters against each other?
Yeah, I was going to say, in fairness, the versus is in the title, at least
exactly.
Of the new movie, right?
Yep. They gave it to us. So we're going to look at 33's King Kong, hold it up against 54's Godzilla. Two classic monster movies enter this conversation. Only one survives. In this corner, King Kong, a David O. Selznick production, directed by Marion C. Cooper and Ernest Shadesack, with Robert Armstrong as bombastic movie maker Carl Denham. Denham basically charters a ship to seek out the legendary Kong on a remote island. He's hoping to film scenes there for an adventure movie that stars an actress he literally just found on the street, Fay Wray's Ann Darrow. Couple of bonus facts research here Sam provided. King Kong did open on March 2, 1933 on two screens, Radio City Music Hall, which had 6,200 seats, and the RKO Roxy, right across the street from Radio City. That one had 3,700 seats. In its first 4 days, Kong sold out every seat, every show, 10 shows a day, and it did
wow.
Go on to become one of the highest grossing films of the 1930s. Now, in the other corner, Godzilla, or as the 1954 original Japanese version is titled, Gojira. Ishiro Honda is the director here. In the story, nuclear testing going on off the coast of Japan wakes up the title creature, who then goes on a rampage. An ensemble cast here, but it does include a familiar face.
Mm-hmm.
Takashi Shimura plays one of the investigating scientists, and Shimura, of course, a regular presence in the films of Akira Kurosawa, notably Rashomon, Ikiru, and Seven Samurai, which you and I revisited not too long ago, Adam. He was the sly leader of the samurai in that film. After opening in Japan in 1954, Godzilla made it to the U.S. It was a heavily edited, Americanized cut known as Godzilla King of the Monsters, released in 1956, and that one featured new scenes of Raymond Burr as an American reporter. You and I, we considered the 1954 original, Adam.
Yes.
Now, when I asked on Facebook and Twitter which of these movies was the better overall film, I got an evenly split response. Good arguments in favor of both. The dilemma was summed up well by C. Walter, goes by @WolfmanWalter13 on Twitter. Both are 5 out of 5 star classics. Stop Motion Kong is more lifelike than the first Godzilla suit slash puppets, but the story, themes, and emotional impact of Godzilla far outpaces King Kong. I couldn't tell you if the Max Steiner or Akira Ifukube score is superior. And Steiner, a familiar name also to us, Adam, came up in our discussion of The Letter as part of our 40s noir marathon. I think that tweet touches on some of the helpful ways to compare Godzilla and King Kong, so that's what we're going to do here. We've broken up our conversation into 5 parts, discussing 5 different elements. So story, performances, special effects, how they relate to the monsters themselves, the metaphorical weight or the message of each movie, and then sort of a catch-all miscellaneous category. We're going to debate which monster has the upper hand in each of those areas, and then hopefully come away with a unanimous decision. I'm curious, Adam, starting here, are you pretty set in your opinion, or are you wavering at all with, could this shift mid-conversation is my question.
You would really have to pull out some kind of magic trick of eloquence to convince me that one of these films isn't better than the other. Maybe not significantly better, though, actually, I think as we get through it, I probably feel that way. I will note, I'm a fan of both films, but I do think there is one that is superior.
Okay. I went into this having a superior film in mind, but re-watching them and thinking about them, it's a little closer than it was originally. So you are kind of in the driver's seat here, Adam. You might help me decide finally. I think I know where I'm leaning, but it is close. It's really close. So I guess we start with story and take it away. What did you make of the story for each of these films?
Well, I'll say first, there are, of course, challenges to comparing these two films. C. Walter said it very well. There are challenges to even this format in the 5 categories we came up with, because I think it's very difficult, obviously, to separate this one out, story and plot, when you consider how integral to any story its characters are, its message is, and for these movies specifically, the monsters are. But I do think in terms of inventiveness and cinematic possibility and wonder, perhaps, I'm going to give the edge to King Kong. You have the director angle, his quest to make a movie unlike anyone has ever seen before, or at least his obsession with making a buck, no matter the risks. You've got the ingenue angle, from poor and destitute on the streets to sailing the high seas and starring in a picture. So you've got the adventure. You've got the romance between her and the first mate and his chivalry in terms of trying to rescue her from Kong. And of course, that romance, if you will, between Kong and the ingenue herself. Skull Island is incredible. The native ceremony that we see that's intended to appease Kong, that ritual, their kidnapping of the ingenue to sacrifice her. And then once you get to the other side of the wall, it's not just Kong that's so incredible. And it's not just a place that's untouched by man. It's like you've walked into Jurassic Park. You know, somehow as soon as you go through the gate, it's as if you've entered a time warp that zaps you from the 20th century back 150 million years. And if all of that isn't enough, one of those creatures, the ruler of that domain, Kong, is later transported to New York City, where he rumbles and rampages through the streets. I feel a little bit like Stefan here from Saturday Night Live, but adventure, romance, fantasy, horror, quasi-sci-fi, this movie has everything. And Godzilla is layered, and it's profound, and we will get into probably all of that. But Kong's imaginativeness, I think, is inarguably one of the reasons it was such a hit, and why it has endured. What about you?
Well, and the other thing about all those story elements you just described, which are intriguing each in their own way, this is a movie that moves. I mean, this thing is lean, it's propulsive. Those things roll into each other. They don't just pile on top of each other in a jumble where it feels like a modern blockbuster, where you're kind of just getting inundated and overwhelmed with how much story there is. It's very well-crafted in terms of moving us from one of those elements to the other. Now, Godzilla, not as streamlined, right? The opening incident in Godzilla where this boat is mysteriously destroyed and they're trying to figure out what has happened. Where are there any survivors? Godzilla spends a lot of time on that. And even as the narrative proper gets underway, there are some slow pockets here and there. I think the love triangle, different than the love triangle we see in Kong among the first mate and Anne and Kong himself, it's way more mundane in Godzilla. And it serves some narrative purposes. I like that it does try to bring some humanity to this story, but I don't think it ever has the resonance of the relationships we see in Kong. One story combination or one story point that is a nice connection, I should say, between the two movies. It was interesting to see the villager in Godzilla talk about how they used to sacrifice girls on a raft
to
appease Godzilla.
One
just
of many
like
similarities between the two films.
That was interesting to watch while holding these two together. But yeah, I think for the reasons you described, Kong does have the edge in story. And there's, you touched on this too, all of those elements are presented in such a mythical way. This is a story that you feel like you could have heard for eons before the movie was made and eons after. It's just, it has this sort of element where you feel like you're sitting around a campfire, hearing something, watching something unfold that is as old as time. Now, we'll get to these elements maybe a little bit later, but I think there's some sexism and racism in Kong's story. The depiction of those islanders, that relationship with the first mate played by Bruce Cabot and Fay Wray's Anne Darrow. So we'll get to that maybe down when we move to metaphor. I don't know if those elements help Kong's story, but overall, we're in agreement. I'm giving this category to Kong.
Okay, it's funny because we are in agreement, though the way we express it is a little bit different. I take your point, and I do see what you were saying, though I actually don't think of Kong as more streamlined. I do think of it as more propulsive, and I understand that point, the energy of it, and Godzilla is definitely more deliberate. But in terms of the plot itself, I think of Godzilla as way more streamlined, actually, just because it's the kind of plot you could describe in one or two sentences. Kong takes you a paragraph or two to really cover all the terrain that it covers.
Yeah, I guess it's streamlined in how it gets us from point A to B to C to D, whereas Godzilla spends a lot of time examining certain plot points in between. It's not just that I wanted more mayhem in Godzilla, but there are kind of low parts in between some of the really good non-Godzilla parts of that movie as well, where the story sags just a bit.
Okay, so let's see if we continue to agree as we get then to characters/performances. Is there a clear winner here for you, Josh?
No, this was a really tough one. And let's go back to Shimura, Takashi Shimura. He is so invaluable to Godzilla in terms of providing that human element that we were talking about. He adds gravity, which I think we know he does to every film that I've seen him in. He also has, though, that small sideways smile that it just kind of keeps you curious about what his character might be thinking. And I can see that smile in Seven Samurai too. He just pulls it out here and there. And what it always does for me is make you wonder, okay, what's going on up there? What is he up to? Or what is he processing? Or what is he going to bring back later in this story that we can see him thinking about now? He's just such a fascinating character actor to watch on screen. And I think he just elevates the performance element to Godzilla. I also did like Akihiko Hirata as Dr. Serizawa. So this is kind of the mad scientist character in Godzilla. He's got an eye patch. He has this lab where he's working on the oxygen destroyer in secret. I love the scenes in the lab, how they're shot very almost like Universal monster movie style. And Serizawa taps into, as a character, the mournful element, I think we'll definitely get to and spend more time on, that is in Godzilla. It's a very subdued performance. His concerns he expresses about, even though this invention might save them now from Godzilla, he's clearly worried about what others will do with it if it gets into the wrong hands. And so there's a connection here with the metaphorical nuclear element in Godzilla. And so I think this is a really strong performance. I also like the touch, which I caught this time. There's a reference that he lost his eye in the war. And so it's just, you know, it shows you how careful the filmmakers are being in Godzilla to recognize what their movie is really about, not just give this guy an eye patch because it looks cool or it makes him look like a mad scientist. You know, they connect it with the underlying concerns going on in the film. So all that to say, the Godzilla performances, I think, are stronger than they're probably given credit for. But is anyone in Godzilla as fun as Armstrong playing Denham, the movie mogul? I mean, he is. How about when they're on the island and they have the first confrontation with the islanders and they all decide, let's back away. Let's, you know, go back to the ship. And he kind of does that. He tips his hat back as he turns, kind of like a little, I don't know. It's not quite like a middle finger to the villagers, but it's a little bit like, I'm not too worried about you, you know?
Yeah.
And there's all these little flourishes in his performance. He's a maniac. He's an absolute maniac when he shoots that dinosaur in the head once they get behind the gate. And then the final line he gets, how nonplussed he is after all this has happened. He's standing over Kong's body and he's just kind of shrugs his shoulders. It's like, well, I'll go on to my next project. So I really did enjoy Denham, and we'll talk about Fay Wray as well. But let me hear what you thought of Denham at least.
Well, here's where we're finally going to diverge a little bit on these films. And I will go back to Sarazawa just for a second. The eye patch is really interesting, too. And maybe it's because I was trying to think of these movies in terms of metaphor. But you could have had him suffering from really any malady or injury from the war to make that same point. I wonder if we're supposed to read into it something about the fact that it's his vision that's blurred, even though he is someone who seems to see the full picture. But in terms of his central dilemma and only seeing, if you will, certain sides of it or trying to weigh both sides, maybe it's not insignificant that they gave him an eye patch. I think that one of these films definitely has performances. One of the ones you spoke of, but only one really has performances and characters. I just don't think there's enough dimension and substance to Denham or to Anne or to Driscoll. I think the potential is there. I'm just not convinced that Kong goes deep enough, and maybe its leading men couldn't go there even if the movie wanted to. I think that Cabot and, yeah, even Armstrong to an extent, I think are serviceable. I mean, I get your little flourishes. I was amused by them too, but there's something about that hammy reading of the famous last line that actually drives me crazy.
Oh no, it wasn't the airplanes. It was beauty killed the beast.
I just hate it.
Well, maybe it's because it's the third or fourth time he's said it,
yeah.
I think, in the movie.
He's finding yet another way to say it, and he really relishes every breath of it. But I don't think Fay Wray's talent can be questioned. You can only question the extent to which the movie takes advantage of it. And I don't want to get too Bechdel testy here, but she doesn't have many lines to begin with. She has to swoon silently over her Cabot's lunkhead on the ship. And then once Kong shows up and she becomes an object for his desire, that's what she becomes for the movie as well. She screams a lot. I'm not sure she says more than about five words for a good chunk of the running time of this movie, though. I feel like that's actually one of the problems, and I haven't revisited the movie or my notes, but I feel like it's one of the problems that maybe Peter Jackson's remake actually solved, giving Naomi Watts's Anne significantly more agency, because without having a stronger sense of her experience and processing that with her, and that combination of total fear and maybe even strange security that Kong's obsession must give her, the movie suffers. I just don't think the filmmakers are really maybe progressive enough, maybe just not daring enough to truly let us connect with her. But then you contrast that, Josh, with how we identify with Emiko and her conflict to reveal what she knows about Sarazawa's creation. Sarazawa's conflict, we've already touched on it. This man of rationality and reason and science, knowing he's made a weapon of mass destruction, albeit one that could save lives and cities if turned against Godzilla, and then that ultimate sacrifice that he has to make. And you mentioned Shimura, this thoughtful academic who sees the destruction and chaos, but who wants Godzilla to live, who feels compassion, among other things, for the creature. And you actually touched on this. There are some similarities between these characters. If you go back to Denim, right? Both Denim and Shimura's character, Dr. Yamane, they both recognize the unique inherent value of their monsters. For the former, that value, though, is all about how he can exploit him for money. For the latter, it's, of course, more humanistic than capitalistic. It's about studying him and learning how he has managed to survive so long. And I think actually it's a bit ironic in the translation in Godzilla, Yamane refers to the creature as priceless. But Denim is also like Sarazawa. He is a sort of mad scientist. He's pushing moral and ethical boundaries for his own experiment. Only Sarazawa, I think more than Denim, actually fully comprehends the consequences of his experiment. So I'm just drawn more to Yamane and more to Sarazawa than I am Denim and Armstrong's performance. And maybe it's not even, if I'm being totally honest, not because I'm such a humanist myself. If Denim was maybe just as reckless, but had been driven just a little bit more by art than commerce, I might feel differently.
I'm going ashore with you, aren't I?
You bet. I don't think she ought to go till we find out what's going on.
Now, wait a minute. Who's running the show? I found out from experience always to keep my cast and my cameras right with me. Never can tell when you want them.
Yeah, but you're crazy to risk it.
Now, Jack, run along and deal out the rifles and ammunition. And get me a couple of huskies to carry my stuff. And, Jack, don't forget the costume box. If we're lucky enough, we make it a swell shot right away.
Yeah, he thinks he's driven by art. This is the, even though he's very honest about being driven by commerce too, he's trying to combine them, right? So this is the hard thing about separating performance from character, because you're right. I like the characters of like Emiko, played by Momoko Koshi. I like Sarazawa, and I definitely like Shimura's scientist better than anyone in King Kong, any of the characters in King Kong. And I do think Shimura gives maybe the best performance out of everything. But man, I enjoyed Armstrong a lot more than you, I think. And I think Fay Wray is really good in what is a very annoying character, because she's so pliable, as you described, especially when she is with Driscoll, Bruce Cabot's first mate. It's maddening in this day and age to watch her so willingly give in to the movie's limitations. You know, that's what's frustrating about it. But I think she's got the great scream, obviously. But I also think that she sells those scenes with Kong, or at least, you know, with the mechanical hand that she's in, as well as this movie is going to have to, if it's going to be sort of iconic and last and not be laughable, she's going to have to sell those scenes in some way and layer them in ways that have more than just the screaming and the fear. And I think she does manage to pull that off. Now, I'm siding again here with Kong in this category, but I'm telling you, Bruce Cabot's Driscoll, the first mate, nearly put me off, because that character is, to be fair to Cabot, he's probably doing exactly what the script is asking him to do.
That girl Denim picked up last night, aren't you?
Yes. I think this is awfully exciting. I've never been on a ship before.
Well, I've never been on one with a woman before.
I guess you don't think much of women on ships, do you?
No, they're a nuisance.
I'll try not to be.
You've been on the way already. Bring that ladder aboard.
Man, is he unlikable. Just the way he even talks to Anne. And as this, he's not even like fun to watch as the dashing heroic figure once he's trying to rescue her from the creatures beyond the gate. So he was kind of maddening to me, but I think on the strength of Armstrong and Fay Wray, I'm gonna stick with Kong in this category too.
Yeah, I'm not really going to defend Driscoll here. I'll just say that maybe I disliked him a little bit less than you, only because I felt like maybe Cabot knew and the movie knew that he was protesting a little bit too much in his seeming disdain for Anne and for all women in
general.
Like it was just setting him up to obviously come around, and maybe it was really about him protecting her all along is why he was kind of talking to her that way. But a difficult performance, a difficult character for sure.
All right, so let's move on. This might be the make or break category for our discussion, Adam. The special effects, the monsters themselves, how they're envisioned. And starting with Kong here, we have to mention effects pioneer Willis O'Brien, also worked on The Lost World, Mighty Joe Young. I had, even though I've seen this movie a number of times, I had forgotten how many close-ups of Kong there were where I'm not sure if it's a puppet head, like this giant puppet head, or some sort of animatronics, early animatronics. But those struck me because the eyes somehow were almost friendly when we get that close look at Kong, except
this in my notes, Josh.
I'll make the distinction when the few fantastic close-ups where he's munching on a person,
right,
then they don't look quite so friendly. But did you notice that too? The eyes?
I did actually. It's one of the things I'm kind of using against Kong in this category, because every time they cut to Kong in close-up, he looks downright genial. It's like he just wants to be friends with everyone. He doesn't understand why everybody's so upset and running around.
But isn't that, I think that's part of the point. I think they're like, there is a movement towards sympathy for him there, rather than being this giant, fearsome, distant creature. Like, we're getting in close.
Even when he's gnawing on someone, Josh?
Well, you know, like I said, then the eyes, they shade a little bit, take a little different shade. But I think for me, you know, the question here is, why does this movie, and I assume you agree, hold up with these stop motion, herky jerky effects that nothing could look, quote unquote, faker than what we get here, yet it's somehow magical? And I think it has something to do with the background work, whether they're matte paintings or the other landscape imagery that the stop motion work is being done in. It's creating this entire world that envelops us, that's very rich and dense and mythical. But it's also the details in the stop motion animation that evoke emotion, they evoke personality. I think about the punch Kong throws at the T-Rex, which is just like, it's not animalistic at all, but it makes him suddenly feel like, oh, he's got a personality too. Like, he's going to throw, he's going to take a swing at this thing. And you see a lot of this during the New York City rampage. I love the touch with how he takes his steel belt off and just whips it to the ground. So it's not just that he's escaping, but he's pissed about being forced to wear this thing. He gives the train car that he derails a few extra punches for good measure. It's just this rage that we're seeing. And so I think it's, you know, if it works, it's not because it's realistic, but it's because it creates this coherent and tantalizing fantasy world that we can get lost in. Audiences did in 33, and I still get lost in it today.
Yeah, you said it very well. The stop motion, there's trick photography, there's miniature models, there's, of course, lots of rear projection, and it does hold up. The overall production design and the art direction as well. There is, you mentioned it, there's nothing about Skull Island or the Empire State Building climax that feels flimsy, even still all these years later. And that's why it's very easy to give the nod to Kong here, because in terms of innovation and being way, way, way ahead of its time, it has to be praised. And there's other elements too. You mentioned the Steiner score. It was groundbreaking in terms of how the music was used here, how sound effects were used. The overall sound design of the RKO sound department was first of its kind in many ways. So that is definitely a key reason why King Kong is such a timeless classic. And I'm with you in terms of Kong probably exhibiting more personality than Godzilla does. Besides his obvious affections for Anne, which is something that Godzilla just wouldn't be capable of. There's not much romance there, I think, with Godzilla. I do like not only the moments you touched on, but I like how he roars on the cliff when he's taken down yet another combatant. Yeah. Right? I mean, we have a lot more sympathy for Godzilla, I think, overall. We will get into that here in a moment. But it's not as if he's got an easy life. Every five steps, there's some other gigantic creature who's trying to take him down. He constantly has to assert his dominance. And there's that moment where he just kind of roars for his own sake and glory. And maybe everyone else in the jungle hears him and they know that he reigns supreme. And that battle with the T-Rex, I like how after he's taken it out and it's dead laying on the ground, he still picks up its jaw and kind of moves it up and down just a little bit, like he's maybe having a little bit of fun with the carcass there. But I do think that Godzilla's set pieces, the ones at least involving people in relation to the monster and that scaling, are more seamless. And yes, it's made 20 years later, so I get it. But there are times with Kong where you feel, at least during those jungle sequences on Skull Island, you feel a little bit like you're on a conveyor belt and you're just an observer as Kong battles these different creatures. You definitely do not feel that way in those sequences in Tokyo and when Godzilla's attacking. And again, the kind of proximity of the characters to the monster is something I didn't quite feel as much with Kong. As I really try to break it down, though, I think this is where I'm incapable of considering the monsters themselves distinct from their context. And maybe there's still enough of a dinosaur nerd in me from my kid days, Josh, where just the large reptile that shoots radiation from its mouth is more fun than a large ape. And even though I said it's not hard to empathize with Kong, who would have been just fine on Skull Island if nobody had ever bothered him, Godzilla is truly a tragic monster who is essentially man-made, forged by hydrogen bomb testing. It's a physical embodiment of man's destructive impulses, forcing man to confront those destructive impulses. And when Kong dies, I'm a little conflicted, but I'm mostly awed. And when Godzilla dies, I'm crushed. So I give the edge, at least in terms of monster, to Godzilla.
Okay. Fascinating. And that's creeping into like metaphorical territory too.
It's the transition, a nice segue I provided for myself.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm trying to parse that out here and stick a little bit more for myself to the effects and how they envision the creatures. I want to go back to your point about the roar, because what I love about that, it's such a great moment. And it also is what I think makes his demise at the top of the Empire State Building so tragic, is because he's at another pinnacle here.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where you feel like he thinks he's won. And then clearly he's been mortally wounded. And that fall he takes is just beautifully drawn out so that it is tragic. And it's kind of the polar opposite of the scene you were describing. So that's just another effects moment that I think is beautiful with Kong. I do want to defend some of the work in Godzilla, because I think a lot of the feedback I saw, people were actually more disrespectful of the Godzilla effect, saying, you know, it's guy in a suit and kind of shoddy and that. And I think there are some shots that don't work quite as well. But right away, the opening shot of this movie, this isn't even really special effects, but it relates to the creature of the water bubbling behind a boat. Mm-hmm. I just loved, you know, since this is my 10th time seeing the film or whatever, how it resembles Godzilla's tail, the water moving, bubbling along. And then I do think Godzilla, when Godzilla's standing in the water, kind of from a distance and splashing around, this has to do with the scale and the immensity that you're talking about, Adam, is awe-inspiring. I think that's when it comes across the best. The underwater cinematography, not, you know, as strong as Creature from the Black Lagoon. So that finale, I think, suffers a little bit from that. And although I do like the detail that we see Godzilla bones at the end, that maybe adds to sort of this element, the tragic element that you're talking about. And you mentioned the sound design. You're so right. The way Godzilla, I think you mentioned it in reference to King Kong, but the sound design here as well is they incorporate air raid sirens. There's very little music during the attacks. And I want to highlight, and this again moves us towards metaphor, Godzilla's scream, this high-pitched, echoing screech.
It's a wail.
It is a wail. And this connects us to the sadness of the story of Godzilla. It's a lament. It's a wail. It's a cry that I think works really well for what the rest of the movie is doing. So, all right. So I'm going to go with Kong in this category too. I'm trying to keep score here.
You're 3-0.
3-0 Kong, and you're...
Yeah, it's a blowout.
You're 2-1 Godzilla?
I am indeed.
Wow. Okay. It's gonna come down to the wire.
Hi, Adam and Josh. Garrett here from North Hollywood, California. I'm so thrilled that you're discussing 1933's King Kong and 1954's Godzilla. I've been a fan of both of these characters since I was a kid, and as much as I love the original King Kong, Ishiro Honda's Godzilla is the better film. In the United States, we tend to look down on Godzilla, maybe in large part because of what American distributors did to those early movies, between their re-edits and the bad English dubs, but the original film is so deeply and profoundly sad. The best sequences don't even feature Godzilla on screen. I'm thinking about the morning after the monster's rampage through Tokyo, as we get those shots of the children being tested for radiation sickness, or the choir singing a prayer for peace on television. Having been released only 9 years after the end of World War II, this movie genuinely feels like a kind of national catharsis filtered through popular entertainment. So thank you guys for having this conversation, and thanks for putting out a great podcast.
We get back into Godzilla v. Kong with that voicemail from listener Garrett Steiger and talk about perfectly setting the table here as we get to our fourth of five categories. We are talking about message / metaphorical weight. To reset briefly, we have pitted these two monster movie classics against each other, 33's Kong and 54's Godzilla. We've talked about their stories, their characters and performances, the monsters themselves, and the effects that brought them to life, but we are getting into the serious stuff now, Josh, and Garrett makes a very impassioned and very strong case for the ultimately very sad Godzilla. Are you in agreement with Garrett?
Absolutely. I think, yeah, he just nailed it. And this is something that even though you know, I think it's one of those things, even if you know the basics of Godzilla, have never seen it, you understand that it is this metaphor for the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and nuclear warfare in general. That's just kind of, you know, part of the legend surrounding the film. But I think it's always shocking to watch it and realize what a priority the movie makes of that and how artfully it communicates it. In between being this rampaging monster movie, you know, it's not just that, oh yeah, he's supposed to represent that and now he destroys a bunch of things. It's also that, think of the very beginning, that there's an immediate concern for survivors in this film. I mentioned how the plot starts with this boat that is lost and no one knows what happens. Think about the scenes that show the families who come to the shipping office to demand to know the names of those three men who are initially found alive on a raft. They want to know their names, and we see the suffering of these families. And so that's just kind of a hint of what this movie is concerned with. And then once we do get to the attack itself, there are little throwaway moments of that mother with her children on the street who says, "We're going to see daddy." Like she just thinks we're not going to make it. And she's telling her kids this. And even this goes back to the creature design a little bit, but even Godzilla oozes radioactivity. The footprints are kind of like these instant hot zones, right? That are dangerous. The creature looks misshapen. There's a lumpiness, almost like it's an atomic burn victim itself. I talked about the wail of sorrow. So I think it's not only that this movie is a clear metaphor, but it's a very potent one in the moment while you're watching it.
It's extremely potent. And this is a case where, as we talk about Kong in terms of its metaphor, it's truly more metaphor because I think it's subtextual. And here with Godzilla, it's pretty much textual. It's there and being dealt with right from the very beginning of the film. As you said, of course, those final lines even of the movie, "'Twas beauty that killed the beast." Kong is trying to deal in that sort of artful realm. And the last line of Godzilla hints at more doom potentially to come if man doesn't figure its act out. It's very anti-war in that way. I, of course, want to get to Godzilla, which I do think is the clear winner of this category. But maybe we can talk about Kong a little bit here, Josh. First, I do think there are many aspects you can mine in Kong. The folly of man trying to control nature, believing he has dominion over the earth, the problems of capitalism. I mean, both are in a line, a single exchange that the Denim character has. He says, "We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear." We'll teach him fear. Yeah. "We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you," right? I mean, it's all right there in those lines. And I will also mention our friend Nathan Rabin, formerly of the AV Club. He wrote an article, I think, when one of the recent Kong movies came out, Skull Island, I think it was. He wrote an article at Vanity Fair that is titled "What Every King Kong Movie Is Really About." And he says of King Kong 1933 that, you know, its racial politics are pretty much in keeping with the racial politics of the time. He says it's pretty racist, but he does also acknowledge that the film can be read as an anti-colonialist allegory in which Kong is actually a proud and untamed indigenous warrior, a king and a free soul in his own world who is captured, kidnapped, taken in shackles across the ocean, and forced to put on a show for the amusement of debauched white people. No wonder he rebels so righteously. In this interpretation, Kong is still a beast rather than the increasingly anthropomorphic creature he would become over the decades, but even in his savage original incarnation, he was already more sympathetic and, yes, human than his captors and hunters, who complicate the film's colonialist and racist undertones by being so over the top in their boorish, ugly American awfulness. They come off not as heroes, but as satirical caricatures of Yankee voraciousness and greed. I think Nathan's right. That element is there. We can get into the gender and sexual politics as well. But I do feel, Josh, ultimately that Kong's achievement, and it is that an achievement, is that it accomplishes exactly what Denham was setting out to do as a director. He says, listen, I'm going out and making the greatest picture in the world, something that nobody's ever seen or heard of. They'll have to think up a lot of new adjectives when I come back. And we spoke to how inventive and how imaginative and groundbreaking it was in so many technical ways. I don't think Marion Cooper and Ernest Shadsack really care about saying or doing anything more profound than that, which is in stark contrast to Godzilla.
Yeah, you have to mine Kong for these metaphorical possibilities. And because of that, you have a myriad of them to choose from. You have some that are admirable, and then you have some that are not, that are questionable. And often they're conflicting each other. So I think Nathan's reading, as far as this anti-colonialist, that's totally there. Kong is this avenger for the colonized, right? At the same time, you totally see that the presentation of the islanders as this fearsome tribe of non-white people is very much steeped in racism, and Kong could be seen as an exaggeration of that.
Kidnapping the white woman.
Well, okay, so there's the really problematic element is that it's so clear that Kong is obsessed with the golden, right? She's described at one point the golden Anne, and so you have this underlying fear of interracial relationships that can be read into the movie as well. And how about, you know, going back to Cabot's role as the first mate and his relationship with Anne, how it's very domineering. And, you know, he's the man and he's going to, if he has to put up with her at all, it's going to be because he has to protect her. And he's going to maybe, all right, against his will, fall in love with her, I guess. And this sort of abusive relationship really is only inflated by Kong. So here suddenly Kong is the Cabot character times 600. It's this, you know, very masculine figure who's going to take what he wants in terms of a woman, dominate her, and that is supposed to be read as romantic. And so I think what's fascinating about Kong is how these good metaphorical possibilities are often undercut by these uncomfortable ones, which isn't to say that this is a movie that needs to be, you know, canceled in any terms, but it does complicate its overall potency as a work of metaphor, whereas for me, Godzilla is much more clear and coherent in what it wants to do. And I think that gives it the edge, even though both of these are rich as metaphorical exercises. I think that's what gives Godzilla ultimately the edge for me.
Yeah. Godzilla, like King Kong, is also to some extent about the folly of man trying to control nature, believing he has dominion over the earth. But this is what Garrett was speaking to and what you were touching on as well, Josh. It's also a portrait of a country that is less than a decade removed from the horrors of the atomic bomb. And it's reckoning with, in a movie that is still fun and thrilling in a lot of ways, it's reckoning with that trauma and what it means to survive, what it means to live every day with that fear, reckoning with how life changes when you know that type of death and destruction is possible, that it can happen to you really at any moment without any warning, when you fully understand what man is capable of doing to each other. It even struck me, Josh, that the residents of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed. It came from the sky. And now here's a Japanese movie that's saying, well, it can come from the water too. Yeah. You know, you're really not safe anywhere. And Garrett alluded to this, the scenes of the fallout from the attack on Tokyo, it feels like footage we've seen from Hiroshima, from Nagasaki. The fire raging in the city looks like newsreel footage. It even struck me that when Sarazawa burns his papers, you know, it's him burning them, and the camera lingers on the fire, on that going up in flames, matching the flames of the city in ruins. There's a lot of shots that linger on the city in Godzilla's wake, and a couple of them really are breathtaking, or other moments that follow it. Like Garrett said, the prayer, that song that the girls sing. That moment you said, Josh, where the mother and the daughters are basically waiting for their death and saying they're going to be where daddy is soon. It hits very hard. And there's even another moment that struck me as kind of one of those throwaway moments, but in a movie that doesn't have any throwaway moments. It's early on. It's before the Tokyo attack. And we see some, I think, students maybe riding on a train. They're going to school, or they're going to work for the day, and they're kind of talking about what this means for their lives. And one of them says, "Oh, evacuate again. Yeah. I'm not doing it this time." And it just makes you think about, you know, you can't compare them too much because King Kong was made in 1933 in the United States. It's in the midst of a depression. You can make the easy argument that it's a film that is treading in this kind of fantasy and adventure and pure escapism for a reason, but we're also not that far removed from World War I at that point. But there's something different about a movie that's being made less than a decade after the atomic bomb is dropped on a country that felt on its homeland the horrors of war. It is, to use your word, a much more mournful movie, a much more serious movie. And the fact that these people have to talk about evacuating again is one thing, but it also says something, I feel, about human nature, that you can see that impending doom. Even like when COVID first hit here, we all heard about it. We knew it was serious. We knew people were dying. And yet there were a lot of people who said, well, I can still be a little careless, or I can still take risks. And this guy is saying, you know what? Even though I remember what it was like, I saw what the horror of war was like and what those bombs did to my countrymen. Well, you know what? I really just want to go on with my life, and I don't want to deal with the hassle of evacuating. You know, that's why a scene like that is in this movie, to make you think about those kinds of questions and dilemmas. And I mentioned earlier that Godzilla is this kind of embodiment of man's destructiveness. Well, it's also, in a way, an embodiment of Japan itself. The professor, Shimura's character, kind of hints at this. He talks about how we should be studying him, not just for its scientific value, but kind of to understand his resourcefulness. It's as if he's saying, you know, we're all like Godzilla. We've all survived this attack. We are all children. We are all men and women of the atomic age. And wouldn't it be good if we knew how to survive in this type of age? And that's why he wants to study Godzilla. So Godzilla just has an agenda that is a lot more provocative and more resonant with me than obviously King Kong does.
Yeah, so it sounds like we agree on this one, at least giving this one to Godzilla. And what you were just talking about kind of leads into the miscellaneous question that I wanted to ask. Which one of these monsters is more sympathetic, ultimately, taking into account everything we've talked about in terms of story and the representation through effects of the creatures, but these metaphors at work too? Is there, because I kind of shifted on this maybe a little bit in this viewing. I think I used to think of Kong as this tragic and misunderstood creature that I could identify with more because there was more personality there, as we've been talking about, mm-hmm. you know? But now I think just giving more weight to the elements of racism and sexism that are there makes me kind of feel like, okay, maybe Kong isn't quite the tragic hero the movie wants him to be.
Mm-hmm.
And Godzilla, again, every time I watch it, feels like a more potent image of this victim who's, you know, at the very least, he's been rudely woken up from a nap. But at the worst, he is this malformed creature from nuclear testing who's seeking some sort of revenge. And so I've kind of shifted on this question a little bit more towards Godzilla, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly, as I said earlier, have some empathy for Kong. Would have been just fine living out its life on Skull Island, right? If no one bothered it, if no one brought King Kong to New York, where it wreaks all that havoc, but you understand why. Of course it's going to, right? It is not in its natural environment, and it's being exploited, not that Kong really understands it in those terms, but there's still something that is so much more tragic about Godzilla, to the point where, as I said earlier, Josh, when we get to the end and we know what is about to happen, and we know what has to happen to Godzilla, I feel like something terrible is about to occur. I want so desperately as a viewer to be able to somehow intercede and find some other solution that doesn't involve killing this creature. And I don't think that there's enough depth, really, to King Kong to provoke those same kind of feelings.
Well, the other thing with Kong is you do have to ask yourself, you know, yes, he could have just been left well enough alone on the island, but we never really learn what happens to, I have to assume there are previous brides who are delivered to Kong by the islanders.
I think we know, Josh.
So that, you know, that puts a different light on Kong's character too.
if he's
been chomping on brides for you know, 100 years.
Yes, but I think that's more something we can damn the movie for, which goes back to your other point about how, you know, Kong probably chomps on the native women without thinking. But as soon as Kong sees Ann Darrow, the white woman, it, of course, stops. But I don't know that you can really blame Kong for being Kong and eating anything otherwise that's given to him.
I mean, he could have stuck to dinosaurs.
Maybe so, Josh. Maybe so. I definitely do feel that Godzilla is more sympathetic. So we are through our categories. I have a pretty decisive win here for Godzilla, 4-1. Now, I do think it probably says something about your own personality and what you even go to the cinema for, which movie you side with here, because I don't begrudge anyone who enjoys the adventure and fantasy and the excitement of King Kong. But I watched this with my daughter, Sophie, about to be 17. I watched it with my son, Quinn, who's about to be 14, and also my son, Connor, who's about to be 11. Now, Connor, I think, was more falling in line with his siblings, but man, right away, before I even said anything, both Sophie and Quinn just exclaimed how much better Godzilla was than King Kong. So my kids even felt like there was something so much weightier and just compelling about the more serious movie. So maybe we're just a bunch of pseudo-intellectuals here in my house.
Well, I've got to ask you, is this, when this idea first came up, I thought you hinted that you don't know if there's much of an argument here, because the case is pretty clear that people think of Kong as a classic and Godzilla as sort of a B movie. So has your thinking shifted after watching the two, or was that not really indicative of the quality? You were just kind of describing their reputations.
Do you mean earlier in this discussion or on a previous show?
No, like when we,
when we
I
first
think it was
threw
like
it out there,
emailing about it or something like that.
Yeah, no, that was definitely my sense, that Kong was this revered classic and that Godzilla absolutely was more of a B picture. And it's funny, I even said too, of course, this is how bad my memory is, I said on that same show, I think, that I had never seen Godzilla 1954. Of course, then I went to Letterboxd and realized that, yeah, I saw it back in 2014, really liked it then as well. But I think what you're getting at is maybe there are more people out there that have seen Kong, maybe they haven't seen Godzilla, or they grew up seeing some of the not quite as good iterations of it over the years, and assuming that Godzilla movies are kind of cheesy. Well, there is nothing cheesy about Godzilla 1954.
Right. And this is where you really have to point people to the 54 Japanese version and not the Raymond Burr one. I mean, you get a hint of what is going on in that American version, but it does not have the power at all. So I would say for myself, going into this, again, both movies I've long loved and have watched many times. There was a wider gap between them, but for me, it is still Kong who comes out on top. I think I gave it 3 out of the 5 categories. And that might, you know, it's so, here's how close it is. The performances category is where I don't quite know where to go. And if I shifted that to Godzilla, it could be Godzilla. I think for me, and I wish I could find who said this on a Twitter somewhat, is that Godzilla's working in the tradition of Kong in a lot of ways as well. And so I do just have this bottom line appreciation of Kong as a foundational cinematic myth.
Yeah.
That when you go back to it, it's one of these that you can see the influences, and you can also see that it isn't just one of these that had some neat ideas it didn't quite accomplish, and that's why it was influential. Mm-hmm. It's influential because it pulled it off. Yeah. And so I'm going to give Kong still the slight edge, perhaps fitting Adam at the end of all this. We end up on different sides.
Fair enough. 1933's King Kong is available to rent on most platforms. It is also currently available to subscribers of HBO Max, or you can look for it at your local library. You can also check your library for 1954's Godzilla, and that too is available to stream on HBO Max, and it's currently free to Criterion Channel subscribers. And Josh, that means the battle is over.
But if others want to still fight it, they can do it on Facebook and Twitter. We're there. Adam is at Film Spotting. I'm at Larson on Film. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Kat Sullivan. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.